Hey.
How you doing?
Yeah, good, man. What's the go? What's the goss?
We're going to touch on this later, I'm sure, but yesterday I was biking my bike through the neighborhood in the morning, and there were a bunch of streets locked down. Cops everywhere, shut down streets, and I was riding past a cop, and I asked her what was going on. She was like, Trump. I live right near the courthouse. Yeah, he's showing up for his trial. Which has happened a few times, actually, since I moved in, but it's pretty funny to feel like the specter of Trump. Around the closed streets yet.
Yeah, it's just not looking forward to hearing endlessly about the election again, but I guess there's no getting away from it. So I was icing my ass the other day.
What? As you do.
I have this joint injury and like on the top of my leg. So easiest access was icing my ass. Did you know you're never supposed to ice yourself for more than like 20 minutes?
I did not know.
I'd never heard that before. But apparently if you do, which is what I did for about 45 minutes, you burn yourself.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ice burn.
I got home that night, I couldn't help but notice my ass in the mirror. And there was like this big burn on it. And then it got worse the next couple days. I was telling my coworker this story. He's like, oh, so is your ass, is it all chaps now? And I laughed. I was like, yeah, instead of wearing assless chaps, I have an ass that's chapped. Anyway, it's getting better now. Just allowed it. Sorry to prelude Russ's episode with talking about my ass, but
I'm sure if he listens to this, he'll find as much delight as we did in that
Also, yeah, public service announcement. Don't ice yourself for too long. I feel like people should know that. We should all, that should be like something that you automatically know. Anyway.
Along with like, don't mix household chemicals together.
Yeah, don't
you could chlorine gas yourself.
Yeah, found that one out too late too. Michael, I finally watched The Train.
Oh yeah, when will you join us, Will, and have watched The Train?
I might do it today. At a Salvation Army, I bought a TV. It's the first TV I've ever owned. It's not up and running yet, but I'm very excited about.
Can I see what it looks like?
Yeah, right here.
Oh yeah, there you go.
And I got also a VHS player, so the enjoyment is going to be through the roof in my living room.
It's great how they were the ones to lock in the best movie title involving a train. They claimed it. But yeah, it's about Nazi stealing art from France, and then a group of saboteurs fuck their train up.
That's so good.
Awesome. I love train related things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite books, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, is A Close Watch on the Trains by the Czech author Boma Hrbal. Also involving Nazis, actually, and trains. Yep. Mm-hmm. Another big recommendation. I believe it was made into a movie. However, I've not seen it because I like the book too much.
I haven't seen any other. Other good train movies. There's Night Train, which I've actually not seen.
Strangers on a Train.
That one's great.
Train Robbery.
Yep. Oriental Express.
What's that Jim Jarmusch one with the train? I think he's kind of annoying, but do you know what the one?
No.
With the train.
There's
Down by Law?
Yeah, that might be it. You know, Wim Wenders likes that movie. It's one of his favorite movies. I learned there was a lovely little Criterion Closet pics I saw on YouTube the other day with Wim Wenders, and he's just such a sick dude. Fucking love that guy.
It has that.
Which is pretty good.
Was it Italian or French guy who wrote and acted in Life is Beautiful? That goofy fella? The one that everyone thinks is a cutie pie? He recently redid Pinocchio. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Roberto Benigni. He plays a live-action Pinocchio.
Roberto Benigni.
Yeah, from Life is Beautiful. That Holocaust.
I'm trying to search his name, and I'm only getting Robert Bikini.
Did he invent the bikini?
You've seen Life is Beautiful, right?
No, I haven't. Should I watch it? I just remember Zizek doesn't like it.
He changes his mind all the time. I heard him saying it yesterday that it's one of the only good comedies on the Holocaust. But he's also said it's one of the worst.
Maybe as a comedy, it's great, but as a Holocaust movie, it's bad.
Holocaust movie, that's good. Zone of Interest. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
It's really like powerful how deeply just the exterior of the movie is.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of keeps you endlessly horribly enthralled. Just
definitely
and the reality of what's going on around them.
It has a, for me, one of the best iterations of the stain in art that I've ever encountered. It's totally amazing. There's a point in the near the end of the movie where, I mean, the movie looks at you. It's incredible. It's kind of shocking. So yeah, recommendation on that front also.
Good date night movie.
When I saw that in the movie theater, there was a guy sitting in the row in front of me fucking eating popcorn. It was unbelievable. And like, he obviously knew that it was a Holocaust movie. You know, but he thought, I think a big bag of popcorn is appropriate.
A popcorn classic.
That'll do, eh?
Yeah.
We have Russ on. Russ is going to tell us about Zizek stock 2024.
Yeah. And he's also going to talk to us about his recent essay, Enjoy Your Trump, or How We Learn to Love the Id and Ignore the Superego. All right.
Cool.
So hello to Russ Sbriglia, all-time returning guest, Russ Sbriglia. Yeah. This is your fourth time, I believe, on the podcast.
This is fourth time? Well,
followed by Zizek, I think, is the close on your heels, but
I don't know which luminary has been more important for us.
How many times has Slavoj been on? Three? Four?
Four, yeah.
I think it's four.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's his namesake, and so
we may make a Sbriglia and so on.
Oh God. Yeah, well, if you know, you guys were doing pretty well, but now I'm afraid you've peaked and now we're on the decline.
Yeah. And then we're out in the street. You're in Mexico right now?
I am.
What are you doing down there?
It's an annual family vacation. So this meeting with you guys is the vacation from the vacation. So how about that?
Sometimes important. What are you getting up to down there?
Nothing. Actually, this is very much like one of Slava's holidays where, you know, he works probably like half the time and then, you know, twice a day, they let him out to experience, the world. Yeah.
It's funny because like Michael's in like ostensibly like a vacation place, Australia, but it just turns out he's just doing the same thing, but he's really hot. It's like, what's different about Michael's experience than mine? He's just hot. He's hotter than I am.
He's sweating, yeah.
So, yeah, we want to do a little promo for Zizek's speaking event at your university, Seton Hall in New Jersey. So, do you want to give us the lowdown on that?
Yeah, I'll give you the deets. So, Slavoj is going to be here the evening of Monday, April 8th, on campus. You guys have been, Peter,
we have,
you guys have been
lovely campus. And
thank you. It's in the same spot. It's in Jubilee Hall Auditorium. It's sponsored by Poetry in the Round, which the first time he spoke at Seton Hall back in like 2018, that was the main sponsor. It's also co-sponsored by the English department, which I'm in, the University Corps and the College of Arts and Sciences. But yes, so it will be at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you're in the New York, New Jersey area, especially if you're in New York, it's a pretty short train ride from Penn Station.
Yeah, easy ride. The tri-state area, that's a thing?
Tri-state area, yeah. Okay. That is a thing.
Pretty easy to get to, and it's a huge hall. How do you need to, is there like a list you need to sign before you, like a RSVP or something?
Great question. So there isn't one because that space is so big relative to the rest of it. I think it holds about 300 people. Now, I've seen events where, you know, Slavoj has spoken, and there have been, you know, 1,000 people or more. But I think because it's in New Jersey, and because he's also doing, I mean, I know we're plugging this event, but I know he's also doing a couple other events in New York. He's going to be in the States for a week or so. So he's speaking, he's doing an event at NYU, actually, the next evening, although I'm sure you can find this online. And then he's also doing an event with, I don't know if it's actually marketed as a debate or a dialogue, but he's doing an event at the New School Thursday, which would be the 11th of April, right? Yeah. With Cornel West. So all that is a way of saying that, you know, the past two times that we've had Slavoj on campus, the hall's been about, Jubilee Auditorium's been about 3/4 full. I think it should, probably people in New York just want to go, you know, if he's close in New York. But we'd love to have people come out and to pack the auditorium for Slavoj. There is no reservation or RSVP or ticket. It's really first come first serve. You know, you show up and there are no reserved seats. As I said, the auditorium fits about 300 people, so. If you're planning on coming, as long as you show up by, you know, around 6:45, you're all but guaranteed a seat. So, but again, we'd love to. Now it will be, I'm like both promoting the event and also saying things that will probably not lower attendance, but I just want people to know it's also going to be live streamed. And the link is already up on YouTube. In fact, Seton Hall ran a news story about it a couple weeks ago now. And that has the link. But if anyone searches, it's actually the news title is, or the news, the story is Zizek returns again. And it has the, from Seton Hall, and it has the link. It has the YouTube link. I think also if we just go to YouTube and type in Zizek Seton Hall, it'll come up. So,
cool.
So right. Those around the globe can watch it, live. But again, if you're in and around the tri-state area, please consider coming by and seeing him flesh.
Very much looking forward to that. And we're going to be there as well.
And there we go.
We'll try not to speak so no one can recognize our voices or anything.
Yeah. You guys will be wearing, it'll be like the Three Marx Brothers. You guys will be wearing some sort of disguise.
We'll have a long trench coat and one of us will be on top, the other in the middle. And yeah. Michael can be the legs.
No, I'll be on top. You guys can carry me.
The event last, I guess a year and a half or so ago, my girlfriend came along, and when we met Zizek, he asked us, like, "Oh, you're in the podcast." And he looks at her, he's like, "Are you involved as well?" And she's like, "No, I'm just hanging around." And she's like, "You know, back in the days of the old Soviet Union, we had a name for someone like you, a fellow traveler." And Todd's nodding along. And then he leans back and he's like, "Yeah, when the revolution comes, you'll be the first to be liquidated." I remember being so jealous that he said that to her and not to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never know when one of those is gonna happen. But
I'm sure he's condemned you to liquidation many times.
Oh, I've been undead for many. I've been a liquid. I've been the. You guys know the post story that Lacan and occasionally Slavoj talk about facts in the case of Monsieur Valdemar, where that's the best ending of any tale. I'm going to butcher the quote, but you know, the quote is something like, what, you know, cause for people who don't know, Valdemar is a character who's been mesmerized, and he's biologically dead, but he's still kept in this mesmeric state. And then like weeks later, you know, he's actually, it's meta language because he's speaking, saying, "I say to you, I am dead." And then all of a sudden, when the spell is broken, it's probably the most disgusting thing ever in literature. One of the most disgusting things ever. He deliquesces into a puddle of, I think it's like the most loathsome, detestable putridity or something like that. So that's, yeah.
That's where you're at.
I've been that for a number of years.
Like in Indiana Jones when all the Nazis melt.
That's exactly. Oh, you know what it reminds me of? The first, wow, great. We're really getting great cinematic examples here. But the first is the first one. Maybe it's the second one. One of the live action X-Men films, where one of the characters just turns into a puddle of water. Yeah, that's
I remember being very disturbed by that as a child.
That's disturbing.
Do you know what the theme of the conversation will be?
Oh, sorry. I thought I was going to mention that. So the theme of the conversation is, it's funny because the poetry in the round, I mean, typically it's just, you know, it's either a poet or a novelist, short story writer comes and they just, so there's no title advertised usually. But I went back in the poetry in the round archives and found out that like in the late 80s and early 90s, we used to bring in philosophers and literary critics more often. So we had Derrida was there as part of poetry in the round. Wow. Harold Bloom, Stanley Cavell, Kenneth Burke. So there is an advertised title, and it's titled "Why Totalitarian Masters Are Obscene," or no, "Why Authoritarian Leaders Are Obscene." That's the official title. Why authoritarian leaders are obscene. You know, that is in line with recent work Slavoj's been talking about this for a while, but you know, increasingly so. And then I know that you recently had Mladen on the podcast, which was incredible. And he also has been working in this vein as well for the past few years. I mean, really ever since Trump and Bolsonaro, Modi, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to release the second half of that conversation soon. And we do speak briefly about that at the end.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Yeah. Okay.
So everyone should join our Patreon if they want to hear it. Except you, we'll send it to you, Rush.
Okay. Well, I should join the Patreon, actually. It's past due.
Yeah. So speaking of obscene masters.
Yes.
Rolled over. We, for our preparation today, we read a recent essay of yours, published in Theory Underground. Enjoy Your Trump, it's called, or How We Learn to Love the Id and Ignore the Superego. Do I detect a hint of reference to Dr. Strangelove in that?
Yeah. The whole title is basically kind of a trope or a meme, right? I mean, there's Enjoy Your Trump, which of course, Enjoy Your Symptom. But then, yes, the subtitle is definitely a Dr. Strangelove reference.
Love that movie. Turning to your essay, you start where Zizek does in Sublime Object with thinking about Marx and the symptom and Marxism and psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
So just a kind of general question about the importance of psychoanalysis for Marxist theory today.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So that piece I had I didn't know if I was going to actually do anything or be able to do anything with the piece because I initially presented it at two different events, one of which was a symposium with Alenka back in 2019. And, you know, we were actually, you know, more than halfway through the first the first Trump presidency. And I didn't really know where to place it. It's not, it's one of my more sort of purely theoretical pieces and political. And then when Underground Theory was putting together that collection, I thought it was perfect. And so I went back and dusted it off and I was like, oh, unfortunately, you know, this is now relevant again. Not that it wasn't, but you know, after 2 years of Biden, everyone was like, oh, enough of Trump, like he's behind us. And now of course he's not. But I came at it from the perspective of what psychoanalysis can bring to political theory, in particular Marxist theory, because now there has been, you know, there's been a lot of work done, I think, academically on the link between psychoanalysis and Marxism. I mean, even before Lacan, I mean, some of the sort of classic Frankfurt School Marxists were already engaging with and showing the ways in which, you know, psychoanalysis relates to Marxist theory. But I feel like overall, when you get to the more sort of hardcore Marxist crowd, that I've started to feel a sense that, you know, psychoanalysis is kind of, you know, unnecessary or superfluous, because what does it have to do with the material conditions of people on the ground? And isn't, especially Lacan, like, isn't this just obscurantism, like postmodern obscurantism that has nothing to do with actual progressivism? And of course, from the Lacanian, let's say Zizekian orientation, that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, you don't need to, you can go all the way back to Freud for that. I mean, the later, more speculative Freud, I mean, he's essentially, you know, a theorist of the cultural unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so I began with that opening, that classic opening chapter of Sublime Object of Ideology. How did Marx invent the symptom? And, you know, basically showed, you know, Marx, Lacan gets that notion of objet A as surplus enjoyment or surplus object from Marx. And so it's kind of inextricably linked. But, you know, we're coming at it, those of us who are in this sort of, who approach things from a more Zizekian lens, I think are kind of Marxists, third almost, after, this isn't true universally, but after Lacan and Hegel. And so this is kind of like, okay, those of you who are in the Marxist camp, let's show you why Lacanian psychoanalysis is actually not just a useful heuristic for our current moment, but also does have practical applications.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So why is it a good heuristic, but also have practical applications?
Well, I mean, so to go back to the Dr. Strangelove subtitle, you know, how we learn to love the id and ignore the superego, is that, so it's actually not entirely true. In fact, that psychoanalysis, let me put it this way. In recent years, psychoanalysis has actually sort of made more of a popular comeback, or has been the lexicon, the language of psychoanalysis has been appearing more frequently in public discourse. In fact, I think in the past year, Chronicle of Higher Education and a couple of other outlets from within and around the academy have published pieces about the return of Freud and the return of the language of psychoanalysis. And it was amazing that when Trump was first running, that you did hear a lot of this. And in the piece, I have, like, you know, probably half a dozen or more examples of Trump being, and this, I haven't heard it in a while. It gets articulated differently now, but the idea that Trump is the id.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it was like, okay, if we are going to use these, part of the impetus behind writing this was, okay, if we are going to use these terms, if we are going to sort of resurrect, at least in the popular imaginary, psychoanalysis, then let's at least be more precise about it. And there are all these things from just, you know, your regular talking heads on cable news to academics who work on Freud and psychoanalysis who, you know, would say Trump is the country's id, or he's the id of the Republican Party, and even going further in some instances and saying that his critics are the superego, and superego is being posited there as a moral agency, which is, to give credit, you know, where it's due, which is how Freud initially theorized it. Although even in The Ego and the Id, and I discussed this in the piece, he has already linked superego to id. I mean, because ego is the filter that's being bombarded on both sides by, you know, from above and below, if you want to think it spatially, like Slavoj does in Pervert's Guide to Cinema with the Bates household, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the ground floor, Norman is the functioning sort of normal, quote unquote, ego. And then upstairs is the maternal superego, the mother bombarding him with the commands. And then in the basement, the fruit seller, right, is the deep reservoir of his, you know, illicit desires. But he transposes the mother, right? Slavoj talks about this, brings her from the attic to the basement, thereby, you know, just proving Freud's point that id and superego are interconnected. Mm-hmm. And he has a famous line, like, you know, superego is not just the thou shalt not, but thou shalt. And so you're getting to enjoyment already. And I'm trying to think of, I always try to think of examples of this. It's like, and the one example I came up with, that's not a prohibition, but is superego, is like, I don't know, this didn't happen to me personally. You know, a child who's reticent to go into the pool or something, and the father just, you're going in, or just like throws you in, right? That's like enjoy exclamation point. as opposed to like, you know, so it's like, that's the thou shalt. And so what I wanted to do was precisely to sort of make the terminology more reflective of, I think, what's actually going on with authoritarian or obscene leader master figures, is that they are figures of the superego. They are figures of enjoyment. Trump, and Bolsonaro, Putin, Modi, Erdogan, whatever. These are all fathers of enjoyment, père jouissance, or père de jouissance, you know, however we want to put it in French. And so it's much more the case that Trump is, you know, I would not say Trump is the id. Yes, of course. Okay. If they're connected, if superego and id are connected, then yes, of course, he also does represent the id. But more than anything else, it's that superego command. It's the connection to enjoyment. An enjoyment that has been prohibited, that has been quote unquote stolen from us, quote unquote, by the other, right? That's the whole point about, you know, make America great again, is that somebody has stolen our enjoyment. And I think I mentioned this in the piece as well. And I told this to Slavoj, and he loved it. It's like, you know, it's another thing where reality is stranger than fiction. But of course, the whole mantra that you know came up between the election and then January 6th and after that, the insurrection, was, and there was a whole group named this, stop the steal. And it's like, stop stealing our enjoyment. You know, whoever is in the occupying that place of the other, you know, Mexican immigrants, Muslim immigrants or refugees, politically correct academics, you know, people who belong to the LGBTQ community, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the initial dichotomy of thinking of him as the id and the Democrats as the superego is kind of already coming from politically, like the Democrat position, trying to make the Democrats into the kind of moral agent?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly. And I think that it's sort of indicative of the fact that in the current political landscape is that's where we go first, or at least, and you know what, I think it's true across the political spectrum. I mean, especially sort of center, left and right. I guess it could be true on both like the far and left and the far right, but moralization. I mean, on the right, this often takes the form of moral panic. And of course, we're seeing, I mean, moral panics, you know, they come and go. But what's consistent with them is that somebody is occupying the position of the other who's stolen our enjoyment. So, yeah, you know, after 9/11, it's Muslims. Now, then, you know, it's gay people, and it's trans people. But it's always constantly shifting. But that's what remains the same.
This need to make Trump the id. Maybe since we moved, we're hearing that less as you've been suggesting. Now he's, you know, like in all capitals, he's a fascist.
Right.
So you need to make him this kind of ultimate evil compared to the moral good of the Democratic.
Right. Right. I got lost on the right, on the right wing response. Right. So the left, and again, I'm going to say it like, I don't mean like, I just mean anything to the left of center.
Liberal, yeah.
Liberal, I mean, often takes the form of just this sort of moralization, right? Mm-hmm. I'm woker, I'm more woke than you, morally, ethically, and therefore I'm in the default position of, moral agent. So in that sort of dynamic, right, it is the Democratic Party or like, you know, liberals who are the superego, which Lacan would not agree with. Mm-hmm. But it shows you that nobody really wants to deal with politics sort of proper. We're still in the realm of moral, of course, morality is important. And we're not even talking about morality necessarily, but moralization. It's just that moralization takes different forms depending upon which side of the political spectrum you're on. And to your point about, you know, Trump, you know, capital, making him, you know, capital F fascist. And, you know, I mean, obviously there are, I mean, you know, Trump is not being very secretive or quiet about what he intends to do when he takes over. And this will be a form of, if he were to win, which I'm afraid I don't want to say that it's likely, but the fact that it, you know, it's a coin flip right now is, especially after the first, you know, his first, what's the term I'm looking for here? His term? First term, boy, I had to really reach for that.
What's the term you're looking for?
What was the term? I was looking for? The first term was that, you know, now it's getting scarier. But by the same token, it's like, look at what the Democratic Party is doing now. I mean, with Trump, it was, you know, kids in cages, you know, this inhumane border policy. And it's like, and Biden was supposed to be, again, like this, under this moralism, like the, you know, the moral beacon, the man of compassion. And now it's like, you know, the Democrats are racing with the Republicans to try to prove that, no, we can be just as draconian or you know, we're just as disturbed by the crisis at the border. And by, you know, Biden said, you know, illegal, the term, someone was an illegal in the State of the Union address a few weeks ago. So, so you see where this gets you. It doesn't get you very far. Mm-hmm.
As you were speaking there, it reminds me of just the ways that the right and left make sense of their reaction to the mainstream, or like they change their tactics with regard to the mainstream. I was listening to a lecture he was given recently about this. He mentions that in 1968, it was common for the students to use very obscene language to kind of rile the figure of the mainstream, of the kind of polite politician. But what we've seen more recently, he points out, is that kind of use of the obscene has shifted to the right. And like you were just saying, there's this de facto kind of moralism that comes in place on the left. Because it seems so much of what the liberal finds abhorrent about Trump is his obscenity, not so much exactly what he does functionally in office. It's more like he just kind of acts the wrong way for them. Because like you were saying with Biden's policies, like broadly speaking, a lot of the, like, there's a lot of similarities and crossover because they both represent basically the, you know, neoliberal economic and political policies.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the first couple of years of the Biden presidency, when he had Ron Klain was the chief of staff, and he was, you know, more labor oriented, further to the left. I think what's going on currently, the United States is, you know, continued support. Now, we did finally make officially call in the UN for a temporary ceasefire. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that, you know, one of the reasons why Trump could very well still win this and is still in it is, I think, electorally, especially with the Electoral College. I don't think Trump has a chance in hell of winning the popular vote, but in places like Michigan and elsewhere. And I want to be, it's not just Arab Americans who are upset, or, I mean, to put it mildly, or, you know, disgusted, entirely disaffected with the Biden administration because of the sort of blank check we seem to have been, you know, have given Israel to conduct what is, you know, an ongoing genocide in Gaza. But that, it's like, okay, so then where is the kind of difference? And I think that your point about, I should be clear. Like, it will be worse under Trump, or would be worse under, hopefully would, conditionally. But it's a sort of, it's a similar thing in that, like, you see how sort of slippery, like, especially I think, like, on both sides of maybe, like, let's, I don't know, I'm going to use it. And it's funny with somebody who, No Americans here, but I'm going to use an American football analogy. Like, if you're like politically, like midfield, 50-yard line, like from the 30 on both sides. So that like 40, like a little, almost like half of the field, the middle, is basically like, that is the problem that they see with Trump, is his obscenity. And in fact, like, you know, when you drill down on it, the most sort of, I don't know, acceptable from the liberal position, left liberal position, the most acceptable Republican is still on board with 99% of what Trump does and his policies. Yeah. It's literally just how he conducts himself and how he goes about it. So, you know, all this hand wringing about, oh, Trump, like, you know, it's the typical sort of man or woman in the diner who are like, you know, well, I don't like what he says. You know, I don't like how he's, it's actually like, they might like what he says. They don't like how he's saying it. They don't like the delivery of it. And so, yeah, it's literally just the sort of sheen that he puts on it that is different. You know, he lets you peep behind the curtain a little bit more than the others do. But the policies,
he's almost being more overt about what the kind of latent intent of a lot of those like policies are. Yeah.
Just briefly, that's what Zizek says, like that liberals have always kind of misunderstood about Trump is like his obscenities are what makes him appealing to his supporters. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a bug in the machine.
No,
because and if you draw this, you make this point in the piece here that liberals might try to dissuade a Trump voter by saying like, look, he didn't achieve any of what he set out to achieve. He didn't build the wall. He didn't do blah blah blah. But it's not actually about his achievements. It's about the kind of attitude and what he says and the enjoyment, the, you know, quote unquote, owning the libs of it all.
Yeah. That really, I mean, I think that really is what it is, because let's be honest. Now in that part of the piece, right, I'm talking about the way in which the main mode of ideology critique, and I should be clear about this too. I mean, as an educator myself, I'm not saying that, you know, argumentation or, you know, rational debate or dialogue and trying to sway people with facts is a bad thing, or that we should stop doing that altogether. But I think that it's pretty clear that when you're dealing with a phenomenon like Trump or the sort of, you know, neo-authoritarian, obscene leader or master, that what's going on there is that people are attracted to this figure, not because of the register of knowledge, but because of the register of enjoyment. And so, yes, it's true that Trump supporters consume all kinds of media that doesn't just obfuscate or elide the truth, but purposely is, you know, misinformation. And so you'll have people who will say, like, it's so funny how it depends upon, I was just watching one of those, you know, I don't know if it was the Daily Show or whatever, you know, where they send a correspondent to, you know, the Trump rallies and whatnot. And it's like, it's amazing how, you know, 2 years ago, for these people, well, the country was great. And under Trump, we had the migrant crisis in quote, like under control and everything. And it's like, it's purely just on what he says. You know, we're going to finish building the wall and everything. Build the wall is another one of these like, you know, chants of enjoyment. And so, yeah, you need to register. I guess this goes back to your sort of earlier question at the outset, is that you need to, in order to properly understand this phenomenon, you know, you could stand up there and tell people that Trump is the one who kept saying fake news, but what they're getting is fake news, and that they're misinformed, and try to show them, you know, you can show them a globe and say, no, the world is not flat, the earth is round, and that's not going to matter, because you're trying to combat this in the register of knowledge, and you're not getting to the register of the libidinal, which is where that investment is. And so I think that that's the most practical thing that a psychoanalytic orientation can bring to the current political realm is, I mean, to go back to one of Slavoj's old phrases, you know, the subtitle of his second book in English, You need to understand enjoyment as a political factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's where the kernel of politics is far more. We know that politics is all about, people like to say it's about feeling and affect. Well, jouissance is that's the one affect. You know, Freud's anxiety doesn't lie. Well, jouissance is tied to anxiety, and so jouissance, you know, does not lie. If you have no sort of theory, libidinal element to your political theory, you're not going to be able to grasp why Trump, et cetera, those figures are so appealing and have such a hold on people.
Given that, like, enjoyment kind of operates politically for both, say, the Democrats and the Republicans, what is it about the figure, this obscene figure with Trump, that embodies that political enjoyment more theoretically or like interestingly for you?
That's a good question. I mean, I address this in the piece as well. I think that when I initially wrote it, it was focused specifically on Trump and the idea of theft of enjoyment and how those on the right, how enjoyment dominates, the right side of the political spectrum. But then the more I sort of, because I gave it as like a 15-minute paper, and the more I started thinking about it, it's just as true that, so the right is enjoying Trump in the sense that Trump, as this father of enjoyment, allows them, well, not only is he going to take back the enjoyment that was stolen from them by the other, but that in doing that, right, because he's the figure who can enjoy, right? Like, I'm able to enjoy. And if you elect me, you can enjoy too, because we'll take all the enjoyment back and make
you get tired of winning.
You'll get so tired of winning, your head will spin. But on the left, I mean, I think it's true, you know, to varying degrees across the spectrum, the full spectrum of the left, but more so like left liberal position, is that this constant enjoying of Trump in a different way of making Trump the sort of center of everything, where it's like, and I like, you know, I like Stephen Colbert and I like, John Stewart. I'm glad John Stewart is back on at least like once a week now, but it's like oh, thank God Trump is back, because now we have this sort of figure that we can actually enjoy in the sense of as a sort of fetish object. Like, because if Trump is the problem, then we can avoid the actual problems that we have altogether, right? Mm-hmm. If Trump represents the greatest threat to democracy, and he does represent a grave threat to democracy, but so do the policies that the Democratic Party, to say nothing of the Republican Party, are still championing, you know, as far as resource allocation, wealth and inequality and distribution, the environment, immigration, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, these problems under what I know you recently had her on, but these problems under what Anna Kornblau would call too late capitalism, are ultimately symptoms of this failure to think about it. And I think we're about to enter another season of this on the left, especially with people, you know, as we get closer to the election, if the numbers remain as they are now, we're going to go back to that moralization. You know, if somebody has a political stance where they're not going to vote for Biden based upon, what the United States has not only countenanced, but has, you know, supported financially and militarily in Gaza. And, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I don't vote based solely upon, you know, I don't view my vote as like, you know, solely an expression of my feelings. I usually vote mostly for harm reduction, but so I think that it's true on both sides of the spectrum. It's just, it's similar to the moralism. Enjoyment is being practiced, or people are enjoying across the left and right. They're enjoying Trump, but they're enjoying him in different ways. On the right, it's like, okay, this will bring us back to the past before wokeness. ruined everything, as they believe. Whereas on the left, it's like, okay, well, if we can just get rid of Trump, then the future will be fine. I mean, if we can get rid of the old pack, but
you had that Biden quote, nothing will fundamentally change.
Nothing will fundamentally change.
I forgot about that, but it's like,
we're stuck in capitalist realism still.
Yeah. Exactly, it seems like capitalism doesn't really care whether or not it's left or right ultimately for its functioning.
No.
And just in terms of the way you were describing like enjoyment functioning for the right, like, yeah, Trump might not have like achieved things and he can kind of blame. There's this endless finger of blame.
Yeah.
But it still functions for the Democrats, for instance, like, oh, if we would pass student loan forgiveness if it weren't for that damn parliamentarian person no one has ever heard of before.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, what's funny is that, and I'm not saying to wipe out, this is not an advocacy of abolishing sort of like all parliamentarian norms or anything like that, but there is no doubt that the Democratic Party, and I think this is true of the Biden administration especially, like really enjoys having this, like, really enjoys liberal proceduralism, because it does give you the figure of, oh, you know, I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that lousy parliamentarian,
yeah.
right? Not allowing me to cancel student debt. It's interesting that, you know, that sort of, even when your bluff is called, you can still fall back on that, right? So it's interesting because one is like, again, on the right, it's like the disregard or the dismantling of all norms. And on the left, it's like, or again, left of center, it's like the insistence upon sticking to the norm is actually what is further degrading.
Yeah, it's in a very cynical way, right?
Completely cynical.
On the one hand, this is one of Zizek's points, is that Trump reveals how the extent to which the law is unwritten, or a lot of the way that the law functions is unwritten.
Yeah.
And then he was just, he wasn't technically breaking often the rule of the law, but he was breaking the norms around it. And then the Democrats would complain about that. But then, they're using the law to ensure that he doesn't run for president again, which is ultimately seems like it's helping him. Like if they didn't.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I was just thinking how it's Trump not getting things done, or, in fact, like the things that he got done that were most effective, I think, were like actually not building things, but dismantling them. Like, so I was just watching something. Who interviewed him like a week ago? Trump. And he said something like, right. So he's the one, his administration is the one that pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal. Right.
Yeah.
And then he was saying the other day, like, now Iran is very, very close to developing a nuke. As far, like, because, yeah, because you pulled us out of the day. Because you pulled out of the day. So it's like, he's, when he says, only, I'm thinking of his, what did he say in his convention speech in 2016? Like, only I can fix it. It's like, well, only I can break it so that then I can come back and then fix it. Yeah, this obscene, circuitousness, or circularity.
But there's also this, you bring up Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. I've also been enjoying Jon Stewart's return. He's always entertaining. But it's something that is so identifiable with Jon Stewart's, like the older iteration of The Daily Show, more specifically, like style about conveying the contradictions and the the hypocrisy of politicians. You call this very appropriately like the non-duped air critique, right? So there's that operating also, this kind of smirking, don't you realize how stupid you are, kind of, and how right I am.
Right.
Mentality.
And that's never been effective, by the way. I mean, it is, I love Jon Stewart, and I think I've watched every single episode because he's doing it once a week now, that since he's been back. You're not converting anyone. Going that way. But
it's been entertaining. But it was a huge miss when he was making fun of Tucker Carlson by saying that prices are so high in America because that's the price of freedom. It's like, okay, well, that's not really the reason why they're high.
Yeah, that was right. I mean, I enjoyed that segment too, but it was also like, that's the obverse of, you know, why was the United States attacked on 9/11? Because they hate our, freedom. Right. By the way, like I just heard it. It's a real banger, but it's from like, you know, however, 20 years ago, but I hadn't heard it in forever, but the David Cross thing about bin Laden and 9/11, if you guys haven't heard that.
And seriously, if the terrorists hated freedom, then the Netherlands would be fucking dust, you know? As would Denmark and Sweden and Switzerland and New Zealand and Canada and every other country that's truly freer than we are. But it's true. And I don't think Osama bin Laden sent those planes in to attack us because he hated our freedom. I think he did it because of our support for Israel and our ties with the Saudi family and all our military bases in Saudi Arabia. You know why I think that? Because that's what he fucking said. Are we a nation of six-year-olds? Answer, yes. God damn it. Why did the bad man put the plane in the building? I said he hated freedom.
Where, you know, he says, you know, well, you could actually listen to what bin Laden said, why, you know, why the attack happened. I'm not saying that that's exactly why, but he's like, or you could reduce it to they hate our freedom. And it's like the most, of course, I remember being, you know, being, was I a sophomore or junior in high school? No, I was in college when that happened. And it was like, that was the answer. And at the time it's like, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They must really hate our freedom.
It's easier. Yeah.
But so I got to run in a couple minutes, guys.
That's cool. We could just maybe drive home again. That it's coming up on April 8th and everyone can join if they like.
Yeah. So Monday the 8th, 7 o'clock, it'll probably go till we have the room until 9 o'clock. So it'll be a 2-hour event and it'll probably be about an hour talk by Savoy, maybe a little bit longer, maybe like an hour. Comes in between like 60, 75 minutes. Or what usually happens is I'll stop. He'll say he's done at about 60 minutes. And then I'll say something that I probably shouldn't have because it'll trigger him to go on for another 15 minutes. And then then we'll have the Q&A for about, yes. So there will be a Q&A and I'm arranging to have books ready. To have books to be sold for a signing afterwards. It'll be brief. Last time, you know, he's very generous, Slavoj, with signing, but it's also going to be sort of late for him and he's just going to be getting in from Ljubljana the day before. So I'm not going to want to exhaust him too much, but if people come with, you know, with a book, it's probably like a one or two, you know, probably like one book per person limit, but there will be books for sale as well. It'll be great. So 7 to 9 in Jubilee Hall Auditorium on the Seton Hall campus. You don't need a reservation. You don't need a ticket, an RSVP, you know, just show up. It's stadium seating. You guys have been there. So, you know, wherever you sit, there's not a bad seat in the house. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. We are too. And
looking forward to seeing you guys.
Yeah,
especially
you too.
Michael.
We should hang out. Yeah. We've never met Michael in person before, so. So it'll be an important time for the podcast as well.
Well, I'll see if I can plant a seed to get, you know, Slavoj to say he wants to liquidate Michael or somebody. We'll see.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And
thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks a lot, Russ.
Cool. Yeah, see you guys soon.
Bye. Talk soon. Bye.
Into one. Thank you.